Hey, oh, let's go.
All right, so have you noticed a lot more motorcycles out on our highways and byways lane splitting recently? It's incredibly dangerous, and it is still illegal. Time for Choke Points with Sully. You've noticed this, obviously.
Yeah, I noticed it. I've got a little personal story coming up from just last weekend. But, I mean, I get text messages and emails from listeners all the time asking me whether or not lane splitting is legal or reporting riders who are doing it. And just this last weekend, as I was driving home from the beach, we were coming up through JBLM and I had a motorcycle rip through the lanes around me at least 15 miles an hour faster than traffic was going. And traffic was going 70.
What?
So this dude was flying. I mean, we're talking laying down from a side. You know that old video game that has the motorcycle you sit on and you really try to crank it one way or the other?
From the
That's
arcade.
What this guy looked like going through traffic. I mean, he was gone in an instant. I couldn't even follow him as he weaved through the cars ahead of me. Well, you know what? One wrong move by him or by any other driver and he would have been gone for good.
We don't want any deaths, let alone motorcycle deaths. And you know, motorcycles just don't win when they get, you know, tangled up with a car.
Washington State Patrol Trooper Rick Johnson says there have already been several serious injury motorcycle crashes since the weather turned nice here in our region. 125 riders were killed on Washington roads last year, a number not seen in decades. About 75 riders die every year in our state. Lane splitting, just to set the table here, is when a motorcycle uses the space between the cars, between the lanes, to pass traffic. It happens most often in slower traffic, but I'm seeing it a lot more at speed.
Check your mirror. Okay, it's clear. Signal, change lanes. And by that time, that motorcycle that's splitting could be into the back of your vehicle. And you're not expecting a motorcycle traveling faster than anybody else to be coming down in between lanes.
I've also had riders pass me on the shoulder in both stop-and-go traffic and at higher speeds. But let's put this to bed once and for all.
And let's be perfectly clear. This behavior is legal or illegal in our state?
Illegal, meaning not legal.
It is not legal?
Not legal.
It has never been legal. The legislature has introduced bills that would allow some limited lane splitting in bumper-to-bumper traffic and on the shoulder, but they've never gotten out of committee. Just because they were introduced doesn't make it legal. In fact, Trooper Johnson says it's the rider's grapevine out there that is spreading misinformation.
Kind of folklore among motorcycling communities when, you know, one person would tell one person, oh, yeah, it passed. One gentleman had a copy of the bill. And I'm like, That's correct. That's a copy of the bill, but it didn't pass.
Yeah, so that's why it'd be funny. He says the guy actually handed him like the RCW, or it's not even an RCW at that point. It's just like a bill digest. It's like, well, yeah, great. That was what they were proposing, but
he wadded it up in his wallet and just get out of jail ticket.
Yeah, it's like, no, I'm sorry. And what Trooper Johnson wants is that for every rider who hears this story or sees it online, to tell every other rider that they know that this is illegal. So we kind of stop that misinformation. Of course, there are riders who do it, knowing perfectly well that it isn't legal. In fact, Trooper Johnson says a rider with hidden plates has been avoiding a traffic stop the last couple of mornings by speeding off and splitting lanes. He was being tracked by a motorcycle trooper.
Yeah.
And the trooper's like, listen, I'm not going to follow you. But
my own life at risk.
Yeah, this person just bailed. So he might be being tracked at this particular moment by an airplane. So what should you do if you're a driver and you see lane splitting?
If you can get a description of what they're wearing, color of the helmet, if you can see a plate, a lot of these bikes that have been running from us, either the plates are flipped up where they aren't visible or they don't have plates at all. You know, direction of travel, what you observe, call 911.
Don't follow the rider, don't up your aggression, call 911, let law enforcement deal with it. Should lane splitting be legal? Trooper Johnson doesn't think it's a good idea for Washington.
I just think it would not be the best traffic safety decision to allow motorcycles to split.
And not necessarily because of the riders, but because riders usually in our area only come out when the weather is nicer, which means they wouldn't be doing this behavior all year round, and the drivers would not ever really get used to this. You know, in Arizona or California, perhaps, where the riders are out all the time in great numbers, you know, maybe something like that makes sense. In fact, it is legal in California, but that's the only state and only in very limited situations at very low speed. So our drivers probably aren't used to this. Our drivers are very unpredictable.
Yeah.
And so I just think everybody needs to give everybody a little bit more room, maybe dial back the speed. And if you are driving on these sunny days and you're up at speed on a freeway, maybe take an extra glance in the side mirror before you get over, just to be safe. You know, just another quick look to make sure your corners, your backside's covered, and hopefully we'll stop running into each other.
And we know a majority of motorcycles out there are safe
completely.
Good folks, and this
totally.
Is just like a bad handful of folks.
Yeah,
not.
But when you see it, yep. you're just like, you're always like, whoa,
yeah. It's
Whoa.
Scary, yeah.
So, yeah, and again, that's a great point, though. Yeah, Travis, totally. But, yeah, it's just we don't want anybody running into each right. other or anything, and our drivers, I don't think, can handle it.
No, agreed. All right, Sully, thanks.
You got it.
This week, a major dam was damaged in Ukraine, putting thousands of lives in jeopardy, as well as a nuclear power plant. CBS's Pamela Falk covers the United Nations. Pamela, any clarity over who is responsible for taking out that dam?
Well, Heather, you're asking the question of the day. To this moment, there is no confirmation from the U.S., U.K., U.N., anyone about who actually bombed or exploded the it's called the Kakhovka plant in Ukraine, and that is because partly because it's in Russian hands. And what that means is that Russia is accusing Ukraine is accusing Russia, but generally speaking, the U.S. said it's leaning toward a determination that it was Russia because Russia controls it. There's no way in, and there are no signs. And that included exclusive drone footage by the Associated Press that showed that there was no explosion or missile from outside. So it would have been an explosion from inside. So all of it is speculation at this point about who actually blew it up, but it did blow up from within. So part of the question is, could it have been sabotage? Was it the Russians? Was it mines? The whole structure was covered in mines by Russia. And so, or something else could have happened, or the dam could have just imploded because it was in such disrepair.
Yeah, some are likening this to a war crime. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it is a war crime, actually. As an international lawyer, I can say, to bomb civilian infrastructure. And this is the main vehicle for drinking water for both Crimea, which, of course, was occupied by Russia, and Ukraine hopes to take it back, and the people of the Kherson region around. But it falls into the Dnieper River, and that's between Russia and Ukraine. So it does have a pretty devastating effect on the Russian side, and you can see from looking at any kind of footage, it has totally flooded the region around the dam, and that has caused both ecological damage, crop failure, and hundreds of thousands of people relocating. And of course, we just don't know until it recedes how many people died from the flooding.
Pamela Falk, CBS News correspondent at the UN in New York this morning. Thank you very much, Pamela.
Good morning. I'm Heather Bosch along with Travis Mayfield. More GOP candidates tossing their hats into the ring in the 2024 presidential race. Joining us now, CBS's Scott McFarland. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. Good to be here.
At this early point in the presidential race, what is key for all these candidates to do right now?
Decide at this moment whether they're going to try to go through Donald Trump or go around Donald Trump. Chris Christie at this point is the only of the announced candidates who has been bold and unbridled in his criticisms of the president. And ultimately, Chris Christie says, why isn't everybody else doing this? If you try to skirt the issue or go around Donald Trump without calling out his name and calling out his actions, you're not going to beat him. And Mike Pence, during his CNN town hall on Wednesday night, was somewhat equivocal when asked about January 6th pardons for rioters, pardons for Trump, whether Trump should be prosecuted. And at this moment, the candidates have to decide if that's a winning strategy or if they have to get a little more unequivocal with their criticisms.
Scott, doesn't this make a problem for some of these candidates if they focus too much attention on Mr. Trump?
There is that issue, and it's not an easy thing to solve. As much as Chris Christie thinks it is, this is an absolutely nettlesome issue for these Republican candidates. There's not a lot of votes to be won in the Republican primary by taking a very hard line on January 6th or being unambiguous with your criticisms of the Republican Party's most recent nominee for president. But to defeat somebody, you've got to try to knock somebody down. And they're going to have to, at some point, raise the intensity of their criticisms or raise the frequency of their criticisms. Or Donald Trump's going to bank that foundational support he has all the way to the nomination. Because you got to remember, in the Republican primaries, it's winner take all in all these primary states. So 25% fundamental support for Donald Trump could win the day everywhere.
So I think going into this whole situation, there were a lot of maybe, you know, mainline, old school, big Republican donors who were really hoping this was going to be a Donald Trump versus, you know, Governor DeSantis race. That is obviously not the race that is shaping up. So is the political chatter right here that that helps Donald Trump, that it is him against kind of everybody else?
He might as well cut campaign checks to these other people getting in the race. I mean, the more that they thin out the non-Trump vote, the better position Donald Trump is. If it became a binary race where everybody ducked out and put their support behind one or two other people, that's trouble for Donald Trump. If he were to go head-to-head or in a three-way race with only that foundational 25 to 30% support. The Democrats did this in 2020. You'll remember everybody bowed out for Joe Biden right there at Super Tuesday to let him go head-to-head against Bernie Sanders, who the Democrats believe is not fully electable against Donald Trump. That could happen in the coming months in the Republican primary, but there's no indication of a party-over-self, you know, philosophy any of these candidates have, that they have to beat Donald Trump, because their message to primary voters is we have to beat Joe Biden, and they all believe they're best positioned to do so.
Yeah, which leads me to, is this it? Is this the primary field, or are there even more Republicans out there who might jump in?
There could be a couple more of much lower name recognition than the ones that are in there now. Maybe a, you know, former member of Congress, maybe a big city mayor, maybe another governor. But I think you're seeing the highest octane names you're going to see so far. And really, it is striking, isn't it, Travis, that a former vice president, the nation's most recent former vice president, got in the race, and it wasn't the marquee event it normally would be. I mean, everything's weird this year. I mean, former president running for nomination, everything's going to stay weird throughout this cycle.
Speaking of weird, traditionally we would expect people, as you mentioned, there was a lot of support for Biden in 2020. His age is coming up as a factor. Do you see that playing a role?
An enormous factor. It's an enormous factor, and Democrats know it. They are bullish on the record Joe Biden has built over these first 3 years, not just from striking a compromise when no compromise seemed possible on the debt ceiling, but the infrastructure bill, which is putting up roads and airport hangars across the country in areas that need new investments. Also, his record of finding pathways forward in a politically divisive Washington. They got a lot to campaign on, but the fact that he's in his 80s and the fact that there's concern from both parties about his age is going to be around their necks from start to finish during this campaign.
CBS News correspondent Scott McFarland in Washington, D.C. for us this morning. Scott, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Travis.
Seattle's Morning News. A major concern across the nation right now with temperatures heating up is smoke created by wildfires. The East Coast is now covered in smoke from fires raging in Canada.
And at this very hour, lawmakers in Washington, D.C. are discussing how the federal government can address wildfires this summer. It raises some really important questions about long-term health implications of smoke, because as we know around here, it can be a yearly thing. And unfortunately, with climate change, it looks like it will be a yearly thing. We're now joined by Dr. Celine Gounder, Clinical Assistant Professor of Medicine and Infectious Diseases at NYU Grossman School of Medicine. Dr. Gounder, how bad is it where you are right now this morning?
Well, it's certainly better than yesterday. Yesterday was like Armageddon. The entire city smelled of campfire smoke. It was yellowy, orange haze in the sky. Today, at least, you can sort of see, but it's still pretty hazy, and it's still not safe. We're still dealing with air quality AQI of over 200 in New York City right now, which is risky for everybody.
Talk to me more about that, Dr. Gounder. What are the immediate health effects of this smoke?
Well, people might experience irritation to the eyes, to the sinuses, headaches, shortness of breath or cough, wheezing, and even chest pain.
Are there long-term effects as well?
There are long-term effects. So this kind of air pollution can cause damage to the lungs, so scarring of the lungs, even lung cancer, as well as cardiovascular disease.
Is this the first time in your experience that New York City and, you know, the Eastern Seaboard has really seen this level of smoke? I mean, because here in the Pacific Northwest, we unfortunately have come to realize that August and September are smoke season. We have to deal with this. And for the last number of years, we have been. It's just awful to deal with. I'm just wondering, is this your first exposure to this level of smoke? And you know, what does that mean for folks? Has it been surprising for people?
Yeah, this is really unprecedented. And I'm not only a New Yorker, but also a former Seattle resident, so have seen what it looks like in the Pacific Northwest as well. But this is really unprecedented. I've been even to cities in the world like New Delhi in India, which has some of the worst air quality. And this is even worse than what I've seen in places like that.
I think what's so frustrating for us is there seems to be no way to avoid this other than just locking ourselves indoors all the windows shut. Yeah. Is there any practical, I mean, what do you tell people who have to be outside for work or other reasons?
Well, unfortunately, some people do have to work outside, right? And so they absolutely should be wearing a mask, whether that's an N95 mask, the heavy-duty mask that you saw worn during the pandemic, or what's called an elastomeric respirator, which you can purchase at your hardware store or online. The big picture, you know, that's not the root cause here. We need to be looking at upstream. What is causing this and how can we be addressing that?
I have seen parents at my kids' elementary school wear these things around their neck. That's like a personal air purifier. I mean, are there any devices out there that can help us? Or is it an N95 mask that really is the thing that is going to protect us? Or, like you said, a full respirator?
Yeah, you really need to be using an N95 mask or a full respirator. Those kinds of gadgets are really useless. There are other things you might think about doing, though. Getting a HEPA air filtration unit for your home, if you didn't already get one during the pandemic, those are effective. You just have to make sure you're using enough of those, depending on how large the space is. You can also build what's called a Corsi box, C-O-R-S-I. If you go on YouTube, you can see how to build one. You can make that out of materials you can buy at any local hardware store, and that's a bit cheaper than buying a HEPA air filtration unit. Also, talk to your HVAC company when they come to service your air conditioner about upgrading your filters. Ideally, you'd be using MERV 13 filters in the home.
That's really good information. I think a lot of folks are probably writing this down right now, the Corsi box especially. Are there any ways also, I think, because we do have to be indoors when this happens, of things we should do to try to, you know, immediately reduce indoor air pollution as well? Because I've read some things about, you know, trying to do that if you have to lock yourself inside.
Right. Well, if you don't have a good seal on your windows and doors, you might put wet towels or rags at the base to help improve the seal. Take off your clothes and shoes when you do come inside because they carry soot on them, and that can get stirred up when you're taking them off in the home. So do that first thing before you go into the rest of the home. Don't smoke indoors. Minimize cooking that might emit smoke, as well as minimize using fuel in the home. And then also sweeping and vacuuming, minimize that right now as well, because that also will stir up any dust or soot in the home.
Really great advice. We really appreciate your time, Dr. Gounder. I hope things clear up in your neck of the woods very quickly.
Thank you so much. Stay
safe.
Your daily dose of kindness is brought to you by Baird, focused on your financial needs since 1919. More than half of the U.S. lives in a child care desert where there's little or no access to child care. Two mothers in Wisconsin took matters into their own hands and decided to open up their own daycare. CBS's Janet Chamlian has their story.
When this daycare shut down, what went through your minds?
What are we going to do? Who's going to take care of our kids?
How is this going to affect my job? Can I keep my job?
I remember calling 12 daycares one day and having all of them be like, wait list, a year and a half, maybe a year.
In Wisconsin, finding childcare is a hardship. There's one spot available for every three kids. That's considered a childcare desert, and 51% of the country lives in one.
So I actually did lose my job. Sorry, I'm emotional.
That's okay.
So yeah, it impacted my performance too much last year.
Could you keep up what you were doing, taking care of your kids and working?
It was hard. Like, I put my family first and set my job. And obviously, got repercussions from him.
Here in Outagamie County, population close to 200,000, more than 1,200 children are on a wait list for child care. And many centers have stopped using a wait list due to the extensive wait. Last November, when this daycare shut down, full-time working moms Virginia Moss and Tiffany Simon took action.
We had dinner together two nights in a row, and we're just running numbers and figuring out what's going to make sense. And we felt like we could do it.
Hi.
They bought the building, and within 2 months, the physical therapist and data consultant opened Joyful Beginnings Academy, hiring management, 20 daycare workers, and enrolling 75 kids.
Can you do that?
Daycare workers here can earn up to $17 an hour, compared to the state average between $11 and $13.
We've seen both sides. We felt the pain both sides. And so now we can go and educate that this is a problem and we need to do something about it.
Why do we got a shovel?
It's a small fix in a desperate area. Their daycare already has a wait list of nearly 100 kids.
If Virginia and Tiffany didn't step in and reopen this daycare facility, where would you all be?
I probably would have had to turn around and sell my home, move in with my family.
Really?
Yeah.
One of us would have probably left our jobs.
What does this child care facility mean to your community?
I think it's bonded our community together, especially living in a neighborhood with a lot of little kids. We all kind of went through the struggle together.
Do you like them?
An American crisis affecting too many families. Meg Oliver, CBS News, Dale, Wisconsin.
Boy, the child care shortage, no joke.
Yes.
No joke. It's very tough for parents. My former husband and I worked opposite shifts constantly so that one of the kids had some kind of care, because it's so tough to find, you know, good daycare too. You don't want to just put your child anywhere. It's just so tough.
And if you can afford it, even then it's competitive to try and find a nanny, get a spot in a daycare, get into preschool. It's like getting into college, and then you pay that
and
price.
Then you're paying
and
the
sometimes
college
it
prices.
Is a college price.
Yeah,
that's right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So good for these parents for doing this all on their own. Hey there, hello, and good morning. This is Seattle's Morning News on Cairo News Radio. I'm Travis Mayfield in for Dave Ross. So, G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo News Radio, and G Scott is here. We were already fired up just in the commercial break about this. You and Ursula talked to Seattle City Council member Sarah Nelson yesterday on the show. And look, this came after the City Council voted on Tuesday to reject this bill that would have given our city attorney the authority to prosecute low-level drug possession and public drug use cases, which basically leaves us back where we've been. With no plan and just the same old, same old. Did Councilmember Nelson have a plan for where we go from here?
Outside of we need more treatment? No. And no one really has a plan, because for all of those out there that says, okay, well, just have the treatment. Well, you need funding for the treatment, right? And that's not right there yet. Here's the part that I want to say this first. Do we have a problem? Yes.
Yeah.
It doesn't take rocket science to know that we have a problem.
Yes.
But my question is this, and I just want to know, it's like when things happen to us in our lives, sometimes the best way to figure things out is to figure out, how do we get here?
Yeah.
How did we get here to where it's so bad? And the problem that we see downtown Seattle, or we see with those some that are unhoused, that are doing drugs. How did we get there? Well, let me simplify it. Because of a 50-year war on drugs that was not really a war on drugs. It was a war on people.
Yeah.
Because if it was a war on drugs, we would have treatment centers everywhere. In 2023, Travis and Heather, we are still saying things like, we need more treatment.
Yeah.
Huh? How is that possible if we were doing the right things? One next thing I want to say, here's another how did we get here? We often talk about the drug users that we see. And let me say this. I don't think any of us want our kids and or our loved ones to go outside and see anyone shooting up any heroin or drugs. That's it. At least I don't.
No, nope.
Okay,
nope.
I want to be clear. Yep. I don't want to see that.
Same, nope.
I don't want to see that. But if we're going to really get to the bottom of these things, then we need to tell the truth about it, because the drug users in our society aren't just the ones you see outside. As a matter of fact, most of the drug users in our society, we don't see. So when you start talking about lock them up, this is why we had a problem in this country with disproportionate incarceration rates for people of color and people who are lower income. So again, if I had a fix to this, I wouldn't be doing radio for a living, right?
Yeah.
So I'll admit I don't have the answers, but I'm going to also admit there has been years and years of inaction that has gotten us here today. And on my Northwest, I write an article, and I asked a question. This is kind of random here, but why does alcohol have such good PR? I've asked that question. Yeah. You know, for an example, if the three of us, Travis, you, Heather, and myself, the three of us all go to a party together, and we go to the party, and everybody's got some red cups and handing out and everything, and then Heather says, sorry, I don't drink. Everybody's looking at Heather as like, what's wrong with her? Right? How do we get here to where alcohol, which has so many deaths per year, gets the good publicity, while drugs, right, gets a bad rap, which I agree that both, too much of anything can be a bad thing. I didn't mean to go too far on that, but I just wanted to say that the reason why we're having such a problem with our drug crisis, but matter of fact, Heather, is drug classes, is that a curriculum in school?
Right now, I don't know.
No, it's not.
I did not know.
It's not.
I had drug classes when I went to school, but I don't know if that's done now.
I had the DARE program show up at my school and then tell us, and then Nancy Reagan and them tell us, just say no.
I was in the Just Say No club.
Right?
I mean, I'm sorry.
There's a lot of things they told us to say no to.
Right.
How'd that work?
Yeah.
We need to see some action.
We
leaders need to step in here. And it really is disappointing to hear council members say, we voted no on something, but we don't have another alternative.
What frustrates me is we need to go back and study. Well, we need to table this. Well, we need to. How long have we been dealing with this? How many studies do we have out there about the homeless crisis? How many studies do we have out there about drugs and alcohol?
You always got to look for the light at the end of the tunnel. And I'm going to say the light at the end of the tunnel is I think that there is more talk about treatment today than there ever was.
That's true.
So on the other side of trauma and heartache is success.
I hope that's where we're headed. G. Scott, thank you very much. Welcome back to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Travis Mayfield in for Dave Ross this morning. Cairo Radio's Mickey Gomez is in studio now. So, Mickey, you sent out this wild story last night.
Yeah.
David, our producer, was like, you've got to see this story. You replied. We were all just talking about it. Oh, my gosh. So it's a teen girl in China apparently spends her family's entire life savings on mobile game transactions.
Right.
$64,000. over 5 months.
Yes.
Wild. How did this happen?
So apparently, well, we're going to call her Annie, okay? Because we're not, she's a minor.
Sure.
And she's reportedly addicted to playing video games. And she goes to a school that is off campus, that is outside of, so like she lives, I guess, off on campus okay, is what I should say.
So she's like a boarding school.
Like a boarding school, exactly. Yeah. And at some point, she had access to her mom's debit card. And she said she remembers her mom telling her the account password from an earlier transaction when she needed to buy something else. So when she got access to that card, she just started purchasing video games online. And when her friends took notice of this, they started pressuring her. Hey, send me some rewards.
What?
Send me some money.
Let me spend your mom's
money
too.
Exactly. But she claims, and up and down, one side and the other, that she didn't realize that this was her family's savings.
Where did she think it was coming from?
Well, you know, when
I guess 13.
When you're 13, you really don't know, which is why I think it is so important to have the conversation with your children about money.
Yeah. Holy smokes.
So, yeah. So she reportedly spent about, what was it, $16,000 on video games, $16,800 buying game accounts, and almost $30,000 on in-game purchases.
Like upgrades and special things.
Right, exactly.
And like,
exactly. And when the mom found out, because she went to go check the account, which, you know, it's a savings account. Okay, I'll give the mom some grace.
Yeah, you're not looking at it daily.
Right, you're not looking at it daily. Yeah. Exactly. But mom probably should have had alerts on her phone.
Yeah.
You know, just in case of bank fraud, things like that. But she saw all of the charges and had to have a conversation with her daughter.
Yeah. And there was like 17 cents left in their account.
Yes, 17.
What?
I probably would have gone pale and passed out.
Yes.
What about these app creators, though? Don't they bear some responsibility here when they see a young person purchasing?
I would think that they would want to notify someone, but maybe not. I'm not exactly sure about that, but that's a really good question, because I tell you what, whenever my son spends money out of his account, I get an automatic notification. As soon as we direct deposit his allowance on Fridays, it's like almost 30 minutes later, I'll get that.
Yeah. So, but David, you're younger than the rest of us. You grew up in the age of smartphones. Did your parents have these conversations with you?
No. My parents don't really know anything about apps and games or anything like that.
So you were draining their savings account?
No. Well, luckily for them, I'm not good at any of the games anything like that. So I didn't have any incentive for it, but I definitely knew of people who had their parents' account for, you know, being able to purchase games, purchase music, whatnot. And you know, not obviously $60,000 worth, but it is a problem that's been persisting. And I think especially in China, I read this is a big thing with kids who are super addicted to these games because it's just so widespread there. So it's, I don't know how to address the issue, but it is a big issue and it has been for years.
Well, they regulated. They ended up, because of cases like this, they ended up putting regulations on a lot of those apps, which say, hey, if you're a teen, you can't play these games.
Yeah, Sully, you mentioned this, a case from like 10 years ago with Smurfberries.
Oh, yeah, and it's something that my son encountered too, when you play those apps and you don't realize that when you make in-game purchases that they're actually tied to the account. And so, yeah, I mean, it's happened ever since the, what do they call it, freemium gaming, which I believe the South Park episode is called Freemium Isn't Free.
Right.
And so, it's been a problem forever. And we had to talk to Tom and go, listen, hey, this is real money you're spending to get fake money in the game. And he's like, oh. So, yeah, we nipped that in the bud right away.
Does anyone remember calling those 1-800 psychic numbers and you had to stay on the line until somebody answered? And if you didn't, if you hung up, you got charged for it. That actually happened to me when I was a teenager.
Oh.
I called one of those Dionne Warwick psychic calls.
Yeah.
And I was on hold for 3 hours. Yes,
oh,
when
my
mom got the phone bill, she called and she got a refund from Southwestern Bell, but it was really hard.
Yeah.
So this mom, actually, of the little girl that we're calling Anne, actually reached out to some of the gaming apps to get some of the money back. And I think she actually reached out to some of the parents' kids as well.
Yeah.
But
give me some money.
Yeah. Help me out here. This is our life saving $64,000. So I'm keeping an eye on the story to see where this goes.
I can understand almost why people would do that, because when you play your own video game and your own little console on the TV, it generally doesn't cost you anything unless you're tied in online.
99 cents,
right?
Adds up quick. Coins, 99 cents.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.